Mustrum Ridcully adjusted the towel around his waist. "How are we doing, Mr. Modo?" The university gardener saluted.
"The tanks are full, Mr. Arch-Chancellor, sir," he said brightly, "and I've been stoking the hot water boilers all day."
The other senior wizards clustered in the doorway.
"Really, Mustrum, I really think this is most unwise," said the lecturer in recent runes. "It was surely sealed up for a purpose."
"Remember what it said on the door," said the dean. "Oh, they just wrote that on it to keep people out," said Ridcully, opening a fresh bar of soap.
"Well, yes," said the chair of indefinite studies. "That's right. That's what people do."
"It's a bathroom," said Ridcully. "You are all acting as if it's some kind of a torture chamber."
"A bathroom," said the dean, "designed by bloody stupid Johnson. Arch-Chancellor Weatherwax only used it once and then had it sealed up. Mustrum, I beg you to reconsider. It's a Johnson."
There was something of a pause, because even Ridcully had to adjust his mind around this. The late, or at least severely delayed, Bergholt Stutley Johnson was generally recognised as the worst inventor in the world, yet in a very specialised sense. Merely bad inventors made things that failed to operate. He wasn't among these small fry. Any fool could make something that did absolutely nothing when you pressed the button. He scorned such fumble-fingered amateurs. Everything he built worked. It just didn't do what it said on the box. If you wanted a small ground-to-air missile, you asked Johnson to design an ornamental fountain. It amounted to pretty much the same thing, but this never discouraged him, or the morbid curiosity of his clients. Music, landscape, gardening, architecture, there was no start to his talents. Nevertheless, it was a little bit surprising to find that Bloody Stupid had turned to bathroom design. But, as Ridcully said, it was known that he had designed and built several large musical organs, and when you got right down to it, it was all just plumbing, wasn't it? The other wizards, who'd been there longer than the Arch-Chancellor, took the view that if Bloody Stupid Johnson had built a fully functional bathroom, he'd actually meant it to be something else.
"You know, I've always felt that Mr. Johnson was a much maligned man," said Ridcully eventually.
"Well, yes, of course he was," said the lecturer in recent runes, clearly exasperated. "That's like saying that jam attracts wasps, you see."
"Not everything he made worked badly," said Ridcully, stoutly, flourishing his scrubbing brush. "Look at that thing they use down in the kitchens for peeling the potatoes, for example."
"Ah, you mean the thing with the brass plate on it saying improved manicure device, Arch-Chancellor?"
"Listen, it's just water," snapped Ridcully. "Even Johnson couldn't do much harm with water. Modo, open the sluices."
The rest of the wizards backed away as the gardener turned a couple of ornate brass wheels.
"I'm fed up with groping around for the soap like you fellows," shouted the Arch-Chancellor, as water gushed through hidden channels. "Hygiene! That's the ticket!"
"Don't say we didn't warn you," said the Dean, shutting the door.
I still haven't worked out where all the pipes lead, sir," Modo ventured.
"We'll find out, never you fear," said Ridcully happily.
He removed his hat and put on a shower cap of his own design. In deference to his profession, it was pointy. He picked up a yellow rubber duck.
"Man the pumps, Mr. Modo, or dwarf them, of course, in your case."
"Yes, Arch-Chancellor."
Modo hauled on a lever. The pipes started a hammering noise, and steam leaked out of a few joints. Ridcully took a last look around the bathroom. It was a hidden treasure, no doubt about it. Say what you like, old Johnson must sometimes have got it right, even if it was only by accident. The entire room, including the floor and ceiling, had been tiled in white, blue and green. In the centre, under its crown of pipes, was Johnson's patent Typhoon, superior indoor ablutorium with automatic soap dish, a sanitary poem in mahogany, rosewood and copper. He'd got Modo to polish every pipe and brass tap until they gleamed. It had taken ages. Ridcully shut the frosted door behind him. The inventor of the ablutionary marvel had decided to make a mere shower a fully controllable experience, and one wall of the large cubicle had a marvellous panel covered with brass taps cast in the shape of mermaids and shells and for some reason pomegranates. There were separate feeds for salt water, hard water and soft water, and huge wheels for accurate control of temperature. Ridcully inspected them with care. Then he stood back, looked around at the tiles, and sang, "Me, me, me." His voice reverberated back at him. "A perfect echo," said Ridcully, one of nature's bathroom baritones. He picked up a speaking tube that had been installed to allow the bather to communicate with the engineer. "All systems go, Mr. Modo."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Ridcully opened the tap marked spray and leapt aside because part of him was still well aware that Johnson's inventiveness didn't just push the edge of the envelope, but often went across the room and out through the wall of the sorting office. A gentle shower of warm water, almost a caressing mist, enveloped him. "My word!" he exclaimed and tried another tap. Shower turned out to be a little more invigorating. Torrent made him gasp for breath, and deluge sent him groping to the panel because the top of his head felt that it was being removed. Wave sloshed a wall of warm salt water from one side of the cubicle to the other before it disappeared into the grating that was set into the middle of the floor.
"Are you all right, sir?"
Modo called out.
"Marvellous! And there's a dozen knobs I haven't tried yet!"
Modo nodded and tapped a valve. Ridcully's voice, raised in what he considered to be song, boomed out through the thick clouds of steam.
"Oh, I knew, an agricultural worker of some description, possibly a thatcher, and I knew him well, and he was a farmer, now I come to think of it, and he had a daughter, and her name, I can't recall at the moment, and where was I? Ah, yes, chorus. Something, 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 a humorously shaped vegetable, a turnip, I believe, something, 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 and a sweet nightingale."
The song shut off suddenly. All Modo could hear was a ferocious gushing noise.
"Arch-Chancellor?"
After a moment, a voice answered from near the ceiling. It sounded somewhat high and hesitant.
I wonder if you would be so very good as to shut the water off from out there, my dear chap. Quite gently, if you wouldn't mind."
Modo carefully spun a wheel. The gushing sound gradually subsided.
Well done," said the voice, but now from somewhere near a floor level.
"Well, jolly good job. I think we can definitely call it a success.
Yes, indeed. I wonder if you could help me walk for a moment. I inexplicably feel a little unsteady on my feet."
Modo pushed open the door and helped Ridcully out and onto a bench. He looked rather pale.
"Yes, indeed," said the Arch-Chancellor, his eyes a little glazed. "Astoundingly successful. Just a minor point, Modo."
"Yes, sir."
"There's a tap in there we perhaps should leave alone for now," said Ridcully. "I esteem it a service if you could go and make a little sign to hang on it."
"Yes, sir."
"Saying, do not touch at all, or something like that."
"Right, sir."
"Hang it on the one marked Old Faithful."
"Yes, sir."
"No need to mention it to the other fellows,
"Yes, sir."
"Ye gods, I've never felt so clean."
From a vantage point among some ornamental tilework near the ceiling, a small gnome in a bowler hat watched Ridcully carefully. When Modo had gone, the Arch-Chancellor slowly began to dry himself on a big fluffy towel. As he got his composure back, so another song wormed its way under his breath.
"On the second day of Hogswatch, I sent my true love back a nasty little letter, oh yes indeed, and a partridge in a pear tree."
The gnome slid down onto the tiles and crept up behind the briskly shaking shape. Ridcully, after a few more trial runs, settled on a song which evolves somewhere on every planet where there are winters. It's often dragooned into the service of some local religion, and a few words are changed, but it's really about things that have to do with gods only in the same way that roots have to do with leaves.
"The rising of the sun and the running of the deer."
Ridcully spun. A corner of wet towel caught the gnome on the ear and flicked it onto its back.
"I saw you creeping up!" roared the Arch-Chancellor. "What's the game, then, eh? Small-time thief, are you?"
The gnome slid backwards on the soapy surface.
"Yeah, what's your game, mister? You ain't supposed to be able to see me."
"I'm a wizard.
We can see things that are really there, you know, said Ridcully. And in the case of the bursar, things that aren't there too. What's in this bag?
You don't want to open the bag, mister. You really don't want to open the bag.
Why? What have you got in it? The gnome sagged.
It ain't what's in it, mister. It's what'll come out. I has to let them out one at a time. No knowing what'd happen if they all gets out at once.
Ridcully looked interested and started to undo the string.
You'll really wish you hadn't, mister, the gnome pleaded.
Will I? What are you doing here, young man?
The gnome gave up.
Well, you know the tooth fairy?
Yes, of course, said Ridcully.
Well, I ain't her, but it's sort of like the same business.
What, you take things away?
Not take away as such, more sort of bring.
Ah, like new teeth?
Like new verrucas, said the gnome.
Death threw the sack into the back of the sledge and climbed in after it.
You're doing well, master, said Albert.
The cushion is still uncomfortable, said Death, hitching his belt. I am not used to a big, fat stomach.
Just a stomach's the best I could do, master. You're starting off with a handicap sort of thing.
Albert unscrewed the top off a bottle of cold tea. All that sherry had made him thirsty.
Doing well, master, he repeated, taking a pull. All the soot in the fireplace, the footprints, them swigged sherries, the sleigh tracks all over the roofs. It's got to work.
You think so?
Sure.
And I made sure some of them saw me. I know if they are peeping, Death added proudly.
Well done, sir.
Yes.
Oh, here's a tip, though. Just ho, ho, ho will do. Don't say cower, brief mortals, unless you want them to grow up to be moneylenders or some such.
Ho, ho, ho.
Yes, you're really getting the hang of it.
Albert looked down hurriedly at his notebook so that Death wouldn't see his face.
Now, I've got to tell you, master, what'll really do some good is a public appearance. Really. Oh, I don't normally do them.
The Hogfather's more of a public figure, master, and one good public appearance will do more good than any amount of letting kids see you by accident. Good for the old belief muscles.
Really? Ho, ho, ho.
Right, right, that's really good, master. Where was I? Yes, the shops will be open late. Lots of kiddies get taken to see the Hogfather, you see. Not the real one, of course, just some old geezer with a pillow up his jumper. Saving your presence, master.
Not real? Ho, ho, ho?
Oh, no, and you don't need...
The children know this? Ho, ho, ho.
Albert scratched his nose.
Suppose so, master.
This should not be. No wonder there has been this difficulty. Belief was compromised. Ho, ho, ho.
Could be, master. The ho, ho.
Where does this travesty take place? Ho, ho, ho.
Albert gave up.
Well, Crumley's in the mall, for one. Very popular, the Hogfather Grotto. They always have a good Hogfather, apparently.
Let's get there and slay them. Ho, ho, ho.
Right you are, master.
That was a pun, or play on words, Albert. I don't know if you noticed.
I'm laughing like hell deep down, sir.
Ho, 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 ho.
Arch-Chancellor Ridcully grinned. He often grinned. He was one of those men who grinned even when they were annoyed, but right now he grinned because he was proud. A little sore still, perhaps, but still proud.
"Amazing bathroom, ain't it?" he said. "They had it walled up, you know. Damn silly thing to do. I mean, perhaps there were a few teething troubles," he shifted gingerly, "but that's only to be expected. It's got everything, do you see? Foot baths in the shape of clamshells. Look, a whole wardrobe for dressing gowns.
And that tub over there's got a big blower thingy, so as you get bubbly water without even having to eat starchy food. And this thingy here with the mermaids holding it up,
There's a special pot for your toenail clippings.
Whoa, it's got everything, this place.
A special pot for nail clippings, said the Veruca Gnome.
Oh, can't be too careful, said Ridcully, lifting the lid of an ornate jar marked bath salts and pulling out a bottle of wine.
Got hold of something like someone's nail clipping and you've got them under your control. That's the real old magic. Dawn of time stuff.
He held the wine bottle up to the light.
Should be cooled nicely by now, he said, extracting the cork.
Verrucas, eh?
Wish I knew why, said the gnome.
You mean you don't know?
Nope. Suddenly I wake up, and I'm the Veruca Gnome.
Puzzling, that, said Ridcully. My dad used to say the Veruca Gnome turned up if you walked around at bare feet, but I never knew you existed. I thought he just made it up. I mean, tooth fairies, yes, and them little buggers that live in flowers used to collect them myself as a lad, but can't recall anything about Verrucas.
He drank thoughtfully. Got a distant cousin called Veruca, as a matter of fact.
It's quite a nice sound, when you come to think of it.
He looked at the gnome over the top of his glass. You didn't become Arch-Chancellor without a feeling for subtle wrongness in a situation. Well, that wasn't quite true. It was more accurate to say that you didn't remain Arch-Chancellor for very long.
Good job, is it?
He said thoughtfully.
Dandruff would be better, said the gnome. At least I'd be out in the fresh air.
I think we'd better check up on this, said Ridcully. Of course, it might be nothing.
Oh, thank you, said the Veruca Gnome gloomily.
It was a magnificent grotto this year, Vernon Crumley told himself. The staff had worked really hard. The Hogfather's sleigh was a work of art in itself, and the pigs looked really real and a wonderful shade of pink. The grotto took up nearly all of the first floor. One of the pixies had been disciplined for smoking behind the magic tinkling waterfall, and the clockwork dolls of all nations, showing how we could all get along, were a bit jerky and giving trouble, but all in all, he told himself, it was a display to delight the hearts of kiddies everywhere. The kiddies were queuing up with their parents and watching the display owlishly. And the money was coming in. Whoa, how the money was coming in. So that the staff would not be tempted, Mr. Crumley had set up an arrangement of overhead wires across the ceilings of the store. In the middle of each floor was a cashier in a little cage. Staff took money from customers, put it in a little clockwork cable car, sent it whizzing overhead to the cashier, who'd make change, and start it rattling back again. Thus, there was no possibility of temptation, and the little trolleys were shooting back and forth like fireworks. Mr. Crumley loved Hogswatch. It was for the kiddies, after all. He tucked his fingers in the pockets of his waistcoat and beamed.
"Everything going well, Miss Harding?"
"Yes, Mr. Crumley," said the cashier meekly.
"Jolly good."
He looked at the pile of coins. A bright little zigzag crackled off them and earthed itself on the metal grill. Mr. Crumley blinked. In front of him, sparks flashed off the steel rims of Miss Harding's spectacles. The grotto display changed. For just a fraction of a second, Mr. Crumley had the sensation of speed, as though what appeared had screeched to a halt, which was ridiculous. The four pink papier-mâché pigs exploded. A cardboard snout bounced off Mr. Crumley's head. There, sweating and grunting in the place where the little piggies had been, were, well, he assumed they were pigs, because hippopotamuses didn't have pointy ears and rings through their noses, but the creatures were huge and grey and bristly, and a cloud of acrid mist hung over each one. And they didn't look sweet. There was nothing charming about them. One turned to look at him with small red eyes, and didn't go oink, which was the sound that Mr. Crumley, born and raised in the city, had always associated with pinks. It went, The sleigh had changed too. He'd been very pleased with that sleigh. It had delicate silver curly bits on it. He'd personally supervised the gluing on of every twinkling star. But the splendour of it was lying in glittering shards around a sledge that looked as though it had been built of crudely sawn tree trunks laid on two massive wooden runners. It looked ancient, and there were faces carved on the wood, nasty, crude, grinning faces that looked quite out of place. Parents were yelling and trying to pull their children away, but they weren't having much luck. The children were gravitating towards it like flies to jam.
Mr. Crumley ran towards the terrible thing, waving his hands.
"Stop that! Stop that!" he screamed. "You'll frighten the kiddies!"
He heard a small boy behind him say, "They've got tusks. Cool." His sister said, "Hey, look, that one's doing a wee." A tremendous cloud of yellow steam arose.
"Look, it's going all the way to the stairs. All those who can't swim, hold on to the banisters."
"They eat you up if you're bad, you know," said a small girl with obvious approval. "All up, even the bones. They crunch them."
Another, older child opined,
"Don't be childish, they're not real. They've just got a wizard in to do the magic. Or it's all done by clockwork. Everyone knows they're not really
One of the boys turned to look at him. The boy moved behind his mother. Mr. Crumley, tears of anger streaming down his face, fought through the milling crowd until he reached the Hogfather's grotto. He grabbed a frightened pixie.
"It's the Campaign for Equal Heights that have done this, isn't it?" he shouted. "They're out to ruin me, and they're ruining it for all the kiddies. Look at the lovely dolls."
The pixie hesitated. Children were clustering around the pigs, despite the continued efforts of their mothers. The small girl was giving one of them an orange. But the animated display of dolls of all nations was definitely in trouble. The musical box underneath was still playing, "Wouldn't it be nice if everyone was nice?" But the rods that animated the figures had got twisted out of shape, so that the Clatchian boy was rhythmically hitting the Omnian girl over the head with his ceremonial spear, while the girl in the Agatean national costume was kicking a small Hlamidosian druid repeatedly in the ear. A chorus of small children was cheering them on indiscriminately.
There's more trouble in the grotto, Mr. Crump," the pixie began.
A red and white figure pushed its way through the crush and rammed a false beard into Mr. Crumley's hands.
"That's it," said the old man in the Hogfather costume. "I don't mind the smell of oranges and the damp trousers, but I ain't putting up with this."
He stamped off through the queue. Mr. Crumley heard him add, "And he's not even doing it right." Mr. Crumley forced his way onward. Someone was sitting in the big chair. There was a child on his knee. The figure was strange. It was definitely in something like a Hogfather costume, but Mr. Crumley's eye kept slipping. It wouldn't focus. It skittered away and tried to put the figure on the very edge of vision. It was like trying to look at your own ear.
"What's going on here? What's going on here?" Mr. Crumley demanded.
A hand took his shoulder firmly. He turned round and looked into the face of a grotto pixie. At least it was wearing the costume of a grotto pixie, although somewhat askew, as if it had been put on in a hurry.
"Who are you?"
The pixie took the soggy cigarette end out of its mouth and leered at him.
"Call me Uncle Heavy," he said.
"You're not a pixie."
"Nah, I'm a fairy cobbler, mister."
Behind Crumley, a voice said,
"And what do you want for Hogswatch, small human?"
Mr. Crumley turned in horror. In front of, well, he had to think of it as the usurping Hogfather, was a small child of indeterminate sex, who seemed to be mostly woolen bobble hat. Mr. Crumley knew how it was supposed to go. It was supposed to go like this. The child was always struck dumb, and the attendant mother would lean forward and catch the Hogfather's eye and say very pointedly, in that voice adults use when they're conspiring against children, "You want a baby tinkler doll, don't you, Doreen? And the just-like-mummy cookery set you've got in the window, and the cut-out kitchen range book. And what do you say?" And the stunned child would murmur,
"Thank you,"
and get given a balloon or an orange. This time, though, it didn't work like that. Mother got as far as, "You want to..."
"Why are your hands on bits of string, child?"
The child looked down the length of its arms to the dangling mittens affixed to its sleeves. It held them up for inspection.
"Clubs,"
it said.
"I see. Very practical."
"Are you real?"
said the bobble hat.
"What do you think?"
The bobble hat sniggered.
"I saw your piggy do a wee,"
it said, and implicit in the tone was the suggestion that this was unlikely to be dethroned as the most enthralling thing the bobble hat had ever seen.
"Oh, good."
"It had a great big..."
"What do you want for Hogswatch?"
said the Hogfather hurriedly. Mother took her economic cue again and said briskly,
"She wants a..."
The Hogfather snapped his fingers impatiently. The mother's mouth slammed shut. The child seemed to sense that here was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and spoke quickly.
I want an army, and a big castle with pointy bits, said the child, and a sword.
What do you say? Prompted the Hogfather.
A big sword, said the child, after a pause for deep cogitation.
That's right.
Uncle Heavy nudged the Hogfather.
They're supposed to say thank you, he said.
Are you sure? People don't normally.
I meant they thank the Hogfather, Albert hissed, which is you, right?
Yes, of course. Ahem. You're supposed to say thank you.
Thank you.
And be good. This is part of the arrangement.
Yes.
Then we have a contract.
The Hogfather reached into his sack and produced a very large model castle with, as correctly interpreted, pointy blue cone roofs on turrets suitable for princesses to be locked in, a box of several hundred assorted knights and warriors, and a sword. It was 4 feet long and glinted along the blade. The mother took a deep breath.
You can't give her that, she screamed. It's not safe.
It's a sword, said the Hogfather. They're not meant to be safe.
She's a child, shouted Crumbly.
It's educational.
What if she cuts herself?
That will be an important lesson.
Uncle Heavy whispered urgently.
Oh, really? Oh, well, it's not for me to argue, I suppose.
The blade went wooden.
And she doesn't want all that other stuff,
said Doreen's mother, in the face of previous testimony. She's a girl. Anyway, I can't afford big posh stuff like that.
I thought I gave it away, said the Hogfather, sounding bewildered.
You do? Said the mother.
You do?
Said Crumbly, who'd been listening in horror.
You don't! That's our merchandise. You can't give it away. Hogwatch isn't about giving it all away. Of course, things are given away, he corrected himself, aware that people were watching. But first, they have to be bought, do you see?
He laughed nervously, increasingly aware of the strangeness around him and the rangy look of Uncle Heavy.
It's not as though the toys are made by little elves at the hub.
Damn right, said Uncle Heavy sagely. You'd have to be a maniac even to think of giving an elf a chisel, lest you want their initials carved on your forehead.
You mean this is all free?
Said Doreen's mother sharply, not to be budged from what she saw as the central point. Mr. Crumley looked helplessly at the toys. They certainly didn't look like any of his stock. Then he tried to look hard at the new Hogfather. Every cell in his brain was telling him that here was a fat, jolly man in a red and white suit. Well, nearly every cell. A few of the sparkier ones were saying that his eyes were reporting something else, but they couldn't quite agree on what. A couple had shut down completely. The words escaped through his teeth.
It seems to be, he said.
Although it was Hogswatch, the university buildings were bustling. Wizards didn't go to bed early in any case, and of course there was the Hogswatch Night Feast to look forward to at midnight. Often they lived to a timescale to suit themselves. Many of the senior ones, of course, lived entirely in the past, but several were like the Professor of Anthropics, who had invented an entire temporal system based on the belief that all the other ones were a mere illusion. Many people are aware of the weak and strong anthropic principles. The weak one says, basically, that it was jolly amazing of the universe to be constructed in such a way that humans could evolve to a point where they make a living in, for example, universities, while the strong one says that, on the contrary, the whole point of the universe was that humans should not only work in universities, but also write for huge sums books with words like cosmic and chaos in the titles. The UU Professor of Anthropics had developed the special and inevitable anthropic principle, which was that the entire reason for the existence of the universe was the eventual evolution of the UU Professor of Anthropics. But this was only a formal statement of the theory which absolutely everyone, with only some minor details of a fill-in-name-here nature, secretly believes to be true. And they're correct. The universe clearly operates for the benefit of humanity. This can be readily seen from the convenient way the sun comes up in the morning when people are ready to start the day. It would give some idea of the scale of the Hogswatch Night Feast that a light snack at UU consisted of a mere 3 or 4 courses, not counting the cheese and nuts. Some of the wizards had been practicing for weeks, The Dean, in particular, could now lift a 20-pound turkey on one fork. Having to wait until midnight merely put a healthy edge on appetites already professionally honed. There was a general air of pleasant expectancy about the place, a general sizzling of salivary glands, a general careful assembling of the pills and powders against the time, many hours ahead, when 18 courses would gang up somewhere below the ribcage and mount a counterattack. Ridcully stepped out into the snow and turned up his collar. The lights were all on in the high-energy magic building.
I don't know, he muttered. Hogs watch night and they're still working. It's just not natural. When I was a student, I'd have been sick twice by now.